Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio on this edition of Garden Talk. Happy 4th of July weekend to you. I'm Larry Mueller. And really happy to have Barb Larson with us. Barb, UW Extension horticulture educator, works out of Kenosha County, and she has a wealth of information to share. We always have a lot of fun when she comes by. One of the things, kind of because it's the 4th of July, she wanted to talk about immigrant plants, and we'll talk a little about that. We'll talk about your garden and how it's doing, and certainly answer any questions that you might have. And if you would like to go to our Facebook page title is The Larry Mueller Show, and you could post a garden photo or question there. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or call. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. And Barb Larson, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be back.
Immigrant plants.
Yeah. So I have to tell you, this all started when I went back to school for horticulture, and my mother gave me a couple of books that she had had and said, you know, I always thought the history of plants was kind of fun. And so I've kind of, over the years, found it really interesting to kind of see what was going on and a little bit of the lore and the legends and that kind of thing. So, you know, a lot of the plants that we think of as kind of typical garden plants and very common in our gardens aren't natives. Yeah. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they're bad or invasive. And a couple of great examples are daylilies and lilacs, which are, of course, really common in the Midwest. And they were both introduced in different ways, but both in the early 1700s. So they've been in the United States or in the North America for a very long time, brought over by early colonists. But the other kind of interesting thing to me about this is when people are looking for old homesteads, especially in the Midwest and in the plains, they look for plantings of lilacs and daylilies because the pioneers, that's what they could easily move.
Buildings are gone.
And the buildings are gone and the barns are gone. And so that's what's left are the daylilies and the lilacs. So, to me, that's the kind of fascinating things about this.
And it's good. And they're good to have.
Sure.
I mean, it's so good. Boy, without daylilies, without lilacs?
Well, right. And especially think of so many, even modern Midwestern homes, that's an important part. It's not just grandma's or the old farmyard.
No.
And there's certainly lots of great things about it. So that's kind of the good ones. Then, of course, there's the other side, Larry. There's the crabgrass.
Yeah.
Which was actually brought to North America by Czechs, Poles, and Hungarians. And it was a grain crop that was really easy to grow in Central Europe. And so they brought crabgrass because it was good for them. That's what they knew. They even had, they called it manna grits. However, they tried for a few years, and although it grew really well here, they found that wheat and corn was much more profitable and grew just as easily. So by that time, the crabgrass
was everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. But they gave it up and just started growing wheat and corn instead.
Well, that's kind of the downside of it.
That's right.
Julie in Mineral Point has a question for you about maybe it's a problem. I don't know. Julie, hi. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on your show. I have a question. I have kind of a orangish red. It's just spotted all over the leaves of a few of my tomato plants. And then I noticed it was on my small apple tree. It just, I'm unsure of if that's a bug or a disease. They're kind of a rust colored, and then once they're on there a while on the back, I notice they turn dark brown.
Well, I'm thinking that we have two different things going on. So I guess part of it is from the description. I'm trying to figure out whether are these moving. Are they like pinhead sized, or are they bigger kind of dots or splotches that kind of may even grow a little bit, or have even yellow halos or circles around them or anything like that?
On the tomato plant, they're pin sized, and they're more, you know, very just scattered all over the leaf. And then on the apple tree, they're more, like you said, a little orange and then with a reddish halo
okay.
around them. So
okay.
They
well,
be too different.
I'm thinking with the apple, I'm wondering if it's one of the rust diseases that you have on the apple, which are a rusty spot. And then they actually will even extend little kind of fingers or projections on the underside of the leaf when they release the spores. They usually they can cause defoliation in the apple. They can also, in some varieties of apples that are really susceptible to it, can even cause problems on the fruits. Because it's a fungus, there's nothing you can do at this point. Any kind of treatment would be preventative. So that would be your kind of typical apple sprays that you would start in as the leaves are starting to come out and everything. But at this point, once you're seeing it, it would be too late. What I usually recommend for rust diseases is getting a resistant variety. And the apple scab diseases would be the same. It's another fungal disease. If you're really attached to this, then you may want to look at putting some sort of preventative sprays on next year.
But
it's too late to do anything now. And we do have a fact sheet on that, so you can either go to the Wisconsin Horticulture website, or you can also go to Brian Huddleston's Wisconsin Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic website. The fact sheets are on both those sites. The tomato spots, there are a lot of tomato leaf diseases. Certainly there's like little black spots that are probably early blight that may be starting, septoria leaf spot maybe. Try to keep those leaves dry, water at the base. I know the problem is we've had so much rainfall that leaf diseases are really going to be pretty rampant, I think, this year. Try to keep them wet. Try to keep them dry. The leaves dry. Water at the base of the plant. Have good air circulation through them. If it's particularly the lower ones, you may even want to pinch some of those lower leaves off. Don't take lots of the leaves off, but a few so that it doesn't then spread on up. The other thing with tomatoes to help prevent leaf disease is I always like to put a mulch down. Some sort of organic mulch to help prevent the splash when the rain hits the ground and keeps the soil from splashing up.
I think Brian's
dried
got
straw. Excuse me.
Oh, I was just gonna...
yeah, straw would be fine.
Yeah, I was just going to say Brian. I think has photos of some of those.
He does
on his
right.
You can take a look and sort of compare.
Yeah, and that's the best way for a lot of those tomato leaf diseases. We've got several fact sheets, so you can either go to the Hort hort.uwex.edu, and in the search, just put tomato disease or tomato in, or you can go to Brian Huddleston's site,
which is
the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, UW-Madison. Okay?
Perfect. All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Julie, for calling. Appreciate it. We have Joya in Fitchburg up next. Hi, Joya.
Hi. Good morning, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two questions. One is about a tulip tree.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether it is an immigrant tree or not, but it's about 6 years old now. It's probably 7.5 feet tall. It's thriving pretty well, but I don't have any flowers.
Okay. So,
Second question is about the peonies. As usual, they're done blooming, and I have some white spots. When is the best time to, cut down the peonies?
Okay.
Okay. So the first one, tulip trees are not native, so they would be an immigrant plant. And if it is sounds like it's growing really well, tulip trees are kind of on the border here in southern Wisconsin. So we can grow them in southern Wisconsin as long as we have a really good site for them, a location for them. It sounds like you probably do. I would say if it's 7 feet tall, it's just not quite old enough yet to produce flowers. So especially trees have to reach a certain age or maturity before they will be able to produce flowers and fruits. The other is that I don't know if you've seen the tulip tree flowers, but they're not... You have to kind of look for them because they come out about the same time the leaves do, and they're kind of a greenish yellow color. They're very pretty, and they're not tiny, so you can't see them, but they don't jump out at you either. So they're not, you have to kind of watch a little bit. But I would guess your tree isn't quite old enough. And then the peonies, which also are another immigrant plant. And one that was moved a lot moved a lot with the pioneers. I'm wondering if when you mentioning white dots, if that is a little powdery mildew coming in. I know I have one of the peonies in my garden is just covered with powdery mildew this year. And so I don't worry about it now, and I just wait and cut them back in the fall after they die back. But I want to make sure that I get all the leaves and stems out of the garden so that it isn't there to reinfect again next year.
Mm-hmm. There we go.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You mentioned all the rain earlier, but here it's been a week now or so, and it's been pretty dry, so we may need to do a little watering.
Right. So the demonstration garden at the county center where I work, yesterday the master gardeners were out watering the raised beds and the new plantings because we haven't had any rain this week. It's been beautiful. It's great growing conditions, but I think we got a little spoiled early on where we were getting rain about every 2 or 3 days, and it was a pretty nice rainfall. And so I think we have to get the hoses out now and start watering.
Ron in Norwalk, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, good morning. How is everyone doing today?
Just great, thank you.
Good. Yeah, I've got an issue with my black raspberry plants.
Okay.
And I think it's Fusarium, if I'm saying that correctly.
Fusarium? Fusarium wilt, sure.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's kind of getting yellow leaves at the bottom, and then they kind of turn brown and die. And I was looking on a website, and they were saying that those spores can stay in the soil for... up to 7 years, is that correct?
Well, I'm not the plant pathologist. In order to know that, I'd have to look it up, or we'd have to talk to Brian Huddleston, who is our plant pathologist. But a lot of those spores will hang around for a long time in and around the soil. I would, in your situation, I would want to actually, you may want to send a sample to the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic and have Brian and his staff confirm that that's actually what it is, because wilting leaves, lots of things can cause wilting leaves. So, I mean, it could be Fusarium, it could be Verticillium, but there are also cane blights, which are fungi that affect the canes or the stems. There are fungal leaf diseases. There are cane borers. Some of those cane blights and the borers, just pruning out the old canes will take care of those. But I would want to have anything confirmed before you do much with it.
Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Barb Larson, our guest today, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Kenosha County. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Next time on Garden Talk, next week, we'll be talking about maintaining healthy soil in our gardens. Right now, visiting about a whole host of garden issues with our guest, Barb Larson, who is a horticulture educator for UW Extension in Kenosha County, and zeroed in a little on immigrant plants to start off with, but now taking a whole series of questions on how your garden is growing. If you'd like to join in, you can call us at 1-800-642-1000. 1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And we did get a post and a photo, which is kind of good, from Jason. Says, and it's a curly Q looking thing. It's found this growth on an elderberry plant yesterday while picking black caps. Wondering if you have any idea what could cause such an odd growth. And it's, I don't know what you'd call it, sort of a curly.
Yeah, it's kind of like a fattened curly. It almost looks like kind of fat worm. And it looks like it is on the stem for the flower cluster.
Yeah.
And so I don't know for sure. My best guess is there are some fungi that will cause this kind of tumor distorted growth on it. And I'm wondering if that's what this is. And it would be, which you've already, he's already pruned it out. So I just prune it out and not worry about it. Sometimes these kind of gall or abnormal growth or tumory kinds of structures are called by insects or mites. But I just, for some reason, that looks like more like some of the ones that are caused by fungi to me. So,
all right.
But in either case, unless he's seeing lots of it, I wouldn't worry about it.
Jan in Caledonia up next. Hi, Jan. Thank you for calling.
Hi, guys. Great show. You said that crabgrass was brought here as a food plant. Does that mean that the seeds are edible?
Well, I don't know, but it sure sounds like it, doesn't it? So,
well, and I haven't. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just saying my research said it was listed as a grain to feed their families. So it sounds like it was used like you do, you know, wheat or anything like that. Yeah, sure.
Oh, that's funny. Well, I'd also like to ask about both teasel and wild parsnips. Were they brought here? And what was the reason, if they were?
So neither one is native. I cannot tell you why they were brought here, though. I'd have to research it. There's so many of them. And some cases, things weren't introduced, as we all know, weren't introduced intentionally. Things like dandelions, we talked about the crabgrass, were intentionally introduced. But it could be that those were not brought for a particular reason. They were in grain mixes or, who knows, soil or all sorts of ways that things get introduced.
Yeah, the stupid wild parsnips, they're the ones that are poisonous, correct?
Yes. So,
toxic on the skin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yes.
Be careful.
Yeah.
That stuff's taken over the whole town of Raymond out here. It's just everywhere. Mm. And, it's scary stuff.
It is very scary stuff. And, in fact, I've had a daughter who is a camp counselor and several times has gotten parsnip burn really badly. So,
So, well, thank you much.
Thanks, Jan, for calling. Appreciate it. We have Mary Bee in Neillsville?
Mary Beth.
Oh, Mary Beth. Sorry. I didn't have the whole name there. Okay.
My question concerns a very old-fashioned white rose bush that has the multiple blooms on it, and it's been in my husband's family. Their mother plant had been there for over 100 years, and when we retired and moved to our new home, I dug up a small slip of it, and I just stuck it in the ground because I didn't know exactly where my flower beds were going to be, and now I've established these beds, and I need to move this rose bush that's been there for 3 years, and I want to know what time of the year should I move this bush?
I would either do it in spring, like April, early May, while it's still dormant, which is probably the best time to move it. But you can also often move these things in September. If you move it in September, I would, after the ground gets really cold, like in late November, Thanksgiving time, then mulch it just because it may not have the roots quite as well established and you want to prevent it from heaving or frost popping out of the ground.
This fall, if I choose not to move it this fall and wait till the spring, should I cut it back this fall after it's done blooming, or, you know, after we have a frost or anything like that, so the plant is maybe a little bit smaller in the spring to move?
Well, sure, you can do it this fall. That would be fine. It's after it dies back, you loses the leaves. I think that would be fine. It will be easier to handle that way. That would be the main reason. Otherwise, you want to try to keep, kind of maximum amount, but you could probably go back to 3 feet tall or so.
Okay. I appreciate the answer. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Tony in Arkansas, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Tony. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have actually two questions. I have recently acquired my grandparents' homestead, an old farmhouse and buildings and stuff. I have three currant bushes that have been here since I was a boy, and I'm 59 years old. When's the best time to break those up and spread them out? Because they're so thick, I can hardly pick them.
Oh, so here I'm going to say, I don't know a lot about currants. I'm wondering if these are ones that really would benefit from a kind of typical pruning where you get in there and cut the biggest stems off right back at the crown or at the ground line, just like you would prune a lot of other shrubs or bushes. Any of the shrub type fruiting plants, we do the same thing. So I think I would do it that way. I don't know how well they break up and break apart. I'm thinking about the one that we've got in our demonstration garden that's been there certainly not 50 years, but and it doesn't sucker and spread that much. So we usually prune it just by thinning it.
Okay.
Have you thought about it? Yeah.
I would do that. You've got, what'd you say? You had three of them?
Yeah.
Yeah. If you do a third of each one.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then do it every year.
Mm-hmm, which is how we normally recommend pruning any of those woody shrubs. And the same way we were talking about raspberries earlier, that's basically what you do with those, too. You take out the old stems or the old canes.
Yeah.
So, I would start with it that way.
Okay. I have a second question.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I've got a barn full of old hay and hay chaff.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to figure out what the best way to compost that would be, because it's like been in the barn for 30 plus years.
Ought to be close to compost.
Is it baled?
Yeah.
Is it baled?
Well, about half of it. But like I said, it's been there so long that the strings are rotten and it is an old barn.
Yeah. It's because it's mostly hay, it's mostly brown. So, it's still going to continue. It's organic matter. It's going to continue to decompose. If you want to speed it up and compost it, you'd want to add something that was a nitrogen source to it. That'll speed it up and moisten it so that it's about like a damp sponge, and periodically kind of turn it and mix it. If you could get fresh manure, that would help out.
Mix it in. And obviously get it out of the barn.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was what I was going to suggest. Not do it inside, do it outside.
No. Right. So I'm glad you and Larry thought of that, because I should have mentioned that first.
I'd get it out of the barn, get it piled up, get the strings off the bales and.
Yeah. And you can, 3 or 4 feet high and long rows about 3 or 4 feet wide. That's how you windrow compost.
Thank you for taking my call.
Okay, thanks.
Appreciate the call. And you have some really good compost there. That could be really good stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Carol in Hudson, we are on to you. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question. I bought last fall a Lapin cherry tree. It's self-fertilizing and didn't realize that it's not a dwarf. And it will get 15 to 20 feet tall and would be totally unsuitable where I have it, which is the only place I can have it.
Okay.
Can I just keep that pruned?
I am not. How small do you want to keep it? Because 15 or 20 feet tall is not tall.
Yeah, that's not really tall. I don't think the other one that I have in the front yard, is maybe more 15.
Okay.
So, yeah, 20 feet. But it spreads, yeah.
Yeah, I'm a great believer in choose a plant that fits in the place, and if it's too big and you're doing pretty extensive pruning, move it, give it to a friend, something like that, because trying to keep something really way down in size when, you know, even a third smaller than what its kind of expected mature height and width are, first of all, it's a maintenance nightmare. It will not produce, it probably won't be that satisfying either for production or for aesthetics
appearance
for you.
Appearance is not going to be good.
Yeah, and so you may or may need to make a hard decision on this one.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Lee in Green Bay, hi, thank you for calling.
Yeah, good morning. I'd like to ask Barb a few questions about the elm family. I've got five American elms on the property now. Finally, one of mine that's roughly 30 years old is succumbing to Dutch elm disease. Mm-hmm. I've noticed it about the last month and a half, 2 months. It's gone.
Okay.
And I also have five accolade elms that I put in 12 to 15 years ago. Do you know anything about how the resistance has been with the accolade elms to Dutch elm disease, and what is our latest on the market cultivar in the elm family that may be resistant?
Okay, so accolade was one of the first elms that was introduced, or one of the earlier groups that was introduced that was resistant to Dutch elm disease. It was bred to be resistant. It was selected for that. And there are a number on the market now. What is the latest one? I can't tell you off the top of my head, but I know there are a number of them now available. A lot of them were developed at Morton Arboretum outside of Chicago, and then I think the National Arboretum also has developed a lot of them. The ones with the National Arboretum introductions have names like Patriot and Liberty, those kinds of kind of patriotic type names. The ones out of the Morton Arboretum have other types of names to them. And I would look at, we do have some nice information. Dr. Laura Jull, who's our woody plant specialist, has put together some recommendations, not specifically to elms, but there may be some in the, we have a publication about fall color. It may be in there, and I think there's some other things. If you want to email me, and the easiest way to find me and find the email is just Google Kenosha UWEX or Kenosha County Extension, and then email me, and I can send you a list of them.
Okay, very good.
Okay.
All right. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way. We open lines now at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We have several emails and Facebook questions, so let's go to some of those. An email from Cindy in New Berlin. Can you prune black oak leaf can you prune back oak leaf hydrangeas, and if so, when?
Oak leafed hydrangeas are one of the hydrangeas that bloom on old wood. So you would prune those back shortly after they bloom. They usually don't require a lot of pruning. And if it's really thick and everything, this is another one like we were talking about earlier, where you want to cut the older stems out at the ground line or at the crown. And if it still looks pretty good, I wouldn't do much pruning at all on it.
We have on Facebook a photo from Nina on our page, and she says, this is a dwarf Mount Royal plum tree. We just planted it this spring. Are these aphids? There doesn't seem to be any sweet sap, and there isn't any webbing. I started at the spots and don't see any moving.
from the photo, and she's showing a picture of the underside of the leaf, it looks like aphids to me.
Me too.
Yeah, it's not totally clear, and I understand it actually is a pretty good photo, but yeah, that looks like aphids. You don't always get this or see the sticky sap with the aphids. Kind of depends on the kind of aphids. Sometimes what is a good indicator is, are you seeing ants around that area? Because ants will actually, they treat aphids like we treat milk cows.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
They will, they're after that sweet honeydew that they excrete. And some plants you will see curling and cupping of the leaves if you have aphids, and you'll see on the inside of that curled cup leaf the aphids, but it sure, yeah, it looks like aphids to me. I would, with aphids, I don't like to use any kind of insecticides if I can avoid it, because I want those beneficial insects like the ladybugs and the ladybug larvae, the lace wings in there feeding on them. In fact, you may even want to look and see if there are these little, oh, they're about a half inch long. They almost look like an alligator kind mm-hmm. of thing, kind of an orange and blacky colors. Those are ladybug larvae. They could very easily be in there feeding with that many aphids. So I either use a hose and kind of spray it off, kind of not trying to knock them off, or if you feel you really need to do something, I would use an insecticidal soap and use one that's actually labeled as an insecticidal soap.
There we go. Thanks so much. We have a note from a question from Stephanie, who posted a photo on our Facebook page of raspberries. She says, what's wrong with the raspberries? The new growth is healthy and green. Stalks with berries are brown and yellow leaved.
Yeah.
She's the Madison area.
Right. And I can see that. I would want to take a closer look at those canes or those stems to see if there's any cracking or any problems with those. And then this is also one where you may want to take it in. And in fact, I would recommend you take it in. And Dane County, is she in the Madison area?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Take it into our friend Lisa Johnson in the Dane County office. Take a sample in, 6 inches or so, 12 inches of a branch that's affected, or an entire cane, and let Lisa take a look at it and see what she thinks may be going on with it.
All right. Thanks a lot for that. And let's turn to Mary in Madison. Hi, Mary. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I was going for a walk the other day, and I passed this house with the most beautiful, unusual-looking tree, and I stopped to ask them what it was, and they thought it was a willow, not a weeping willow. The leaves kind of reminded me of an Edelweiss plant, kind of that whitish-green, and it was perfectly shaped and beautiful, and I'm wondering if that sounds like a willow tree to you. And I'm just curious. My son needs some landscaping, and I thought that would be the perfect thing to plant.
It could be. There are some willows that do have kind of that nice kind of gray-green colored foliage on them. I can't tell you anything more than it could be.
The leaves were kind of pointy. They weren't round, and the tree wasn't huge, although it had been there for about 12 years.
Yeah.
And it, like I said, it reminded me so much of an Edelweiss plant, and I think the people who lived there didn't plant it, and that was what they were told. So I didn't search a long time, but what I did find online for a willow tree did not look like that.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. Well, there are lots of different kinds of willows. And so because it's on somebody else's property, you may not want to take a clipping of it.
Right.
But you could take some.
Take a nice
some,
photo.
Yeah, a couple of photos. We'd need to see. not only the leaves, but how they come off the stem. So are they opposite or alternate? You know, how do they attach and some of those kinds of things.
Okay.
And then if you want, you can email me pictures and I can try to take a look, identify it for you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can you mention your email address?
The easiest way is to just Google Kenosha County UW Extension.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Dan in Manawa, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. See, I have a black walnut on my property.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And I had thought I had heard that it can affect your garden up to 100 feet away. Is that right?
Yep.
Yep. Yeah. Well, that's the short answer.
150. What does it do?
If it's a full grown.
Oh yeah, I've lived here for 33 years, and it's been here since I've been here.
Oh yeah, yeah. So walnuts, black walnuts produce a substance called juglone, and it prevents. Many other plants from growing in and around that black walnut tree. And that
especially the Solanaceae, so tomatoes.
Tomatoes and yeah.
Yeah, well, the grass sure grows okay.
Absolutely. Grass isn't affected by it. So, yeah, you can grow grasses around it. And there are plants, black walnut, we were talking about immigrant versus native plants. Black walnut's a native plant. So there are native plants that and non-native plants that do grow in and around black walnut. But certain plants are really affected by that juglone. So if you've been there a long time and whatever you're growing, it's fine. You're okay. You don't have to worry about it.
Well,
but,
I'm right on the edge of that 150.
Yeah. So the problem is that it's in the roots, it's in the leaves, it's in the nuts, it's in the stems, it's, you know, that kind of thing. So just make sure you keep the leaves out of your garden and the nuts out of the, and all those kinds of things.
And those roots are going to go beyond the drip line.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
roots go two to five times.
My garden's way beyond the root line. So.
Well, but roots go anywhere from 3 to 5 times the height of the tree. That's how far they'll go out.
Oh, my God.
So
okay,
I would just keep an eye on things. And if you're starting to see things kind of stunted, or if you even see an area of your garden that's starting to be stunted, you may have roots underneath that part.
And there are there.
I missed that word you're saying. Start to be sunken?
Stunted. Shorter than they should
stunted.
Be.
Stunted. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
And there are things you can do. I mean, there are ways that you can still grow tomatoes.
Oh, yeah.
You can use straw bales. You can do straw bale gardening. You can do raised beds.
You can do containers. And until you see this is like don't borrow trouble. So until you start seeing problems, I wouldn't worry too much about it.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Hey, you've been very helpful. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Okay. Appreciate it. And Dave in Cumberland, we'll get to you in just a minute. Just a reminder, as you listen, Barb Larson, our guest today, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Kenosha County. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Barb Larson, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Kenosha County. Join in Facebook. Go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question, comment, or photo there. Call us at 800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. And we have on Facebook another pretty good photo, actually. Lauren sent us a photo of a magnolia tree. She thinks it has magnolia scale. And she's right about that, isn't she?
Yes, she is. It is magnolia scale. And then she's also, it has kind of very dark spots on the leaves. And I think she's asking, what is that? That is sooty mold that is growing on the honeydew or the sweet excrement from the scales. And it's a fungus and does happen with a lot of those, especially some of them that excrete a lot of it. And she's wanting to know what to do about magnolia scale. We do have a fact sheet on that, so that
there
will
tell
you.
Are some organic options for that?
I'm pretty sure there are, or some ones that something that's available. One organic could probably, and timing becomes a little tricky on this, but there are probably some oil products that she can use, some horticultural oils, and those would be organic. And this is off the top of my head, so don't everybody run out and say, this is what Barb said, check the fact sheet. And that's on either the Wisconsin Horticulture website, the Extension Horticulture website, or this is another one that's on the Plant Disease Diagnostic website. And it's called Magnolia Scale. Or you could even Google Wisconsin Extension Magnolia Scale, and that'll bring it up. That's probably the fastest way.
Pop it right up.
Yep.
Dave in Cumberland. Hi, thanks for calling.
Good morning. Thanks for having the program.
Sure.
I have two questions for you. First one is there such a thing as volunteer rhubarb?
There's a weed that looks a lot like rhubarb.
Yeah, there is.
Okay.
Yeah, burdock looks a lot like rhubarb, so I wouldn't eat it unless you have it identified.
Well, I'm not going to eat it.
Oh, okay.
I just found a plant, and it's a huge plant growing in and amongst my Japanese knotweed, which is the second question. How in the heck do you get rid of that?
That's
bad.
Persistence. That's one. There's a lot of really good information, both from the DNR and the Midwest Invasive Plants Network, and that will include information on getting rid of some of these nasty invasive species, and Japanese knotweed is one of them. So I would look that up online, and it will give you recommendations. Most of the time, this is going to require persistence and repeat treatment, because one herbicide spray is not going to take care of it, as you all probably already know.
Yep.
Yes, I haven't really tried to control it yet because it's not a factor in my lawn.
Mm.
It is a factor on my property.
Yeah.
It's not affecting anything.
Yeah, but really think about being a good steward of the environment and start getting rid of this thing before it gets worse. Because it not only will it spread on yours, it spreads other places too. So
yeah, so
get rid of it if you can.
Get rid of it, Dave. Thank you very much for calling. Joel in Ingleside, Illinois, up next. Hi, Joel.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
At the beginning of the program, one of the things you'd mentioned was daylilies as being not invasive. That's not my experience with them. I've got 4.5 acres, mostly wooded, and I've got patches of daylilies that have sprung up all over the place. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of them. And spraying them doesn't seem to do a thing to them. It just runs right off. The only thing that I found that works is very labor-intensive. I get down, I snip each stem, put a drop of Roundup on the cut stem, but that just takes forever. Is there anything else that works better?
Timing is going to be important, and yeah, especially if you've got those old-fashioned orange daylilies. I understand that. And they do get into lots of different places. So, where is it invasive? Some of this is the eye of the beholder on this.
Yeah.
Timing, when you're trying to get rid of a perennial plant, early fall, so September, October, is really the best time to treat them with an herbicide. Have you been trying to do it at that time?
No, I've been doing it mostly in the spring.
Yeah, and so I definitely switch to that early fall. And the reason it's more effective is at that time, that's when the plant is pulling back the carbohydrates and the nutrients down into the root system, and it will pull the herbicide back down in at that time, too. They're just still going to be a problem. Yeah, just the opposite of the spring. So,
okay.
So try it that way and kind of keep after it.
All right, good luck. Okay? Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And we have a Facebook photo from Kitty. It says, I moved into a new home this spring and this funky above-ground onion was here. What's it called and is it edible? And she just kind of laid it on. Looks like she just... It's not growing there. That's something she pulled.
Right. Well, there is something called a walking onion, and that looks like a walking onion.
Yeah, it does.
And yes, they are edible. And so I think it depends on whether you want to keep it or not. And it's called a walking onion because they grow those little clusters on the top of the stems, and then it falls over and it kind of self-propagates itself that way. So, but yeah, they're edible.
Bob in Lancaster, thanks for calling. Hi.
Good morning. Two totally unrelated questions. Are the apples being formed early this year? They on my trees, they seem about a month early. You know, really large and...
I can't tell you. I don't know. I haven't heard... You're the first person that's mentioned that. I honestly have not been out to the orchard behind my office to see if things are ahead of schedule this year. We've had a lot of rainfall, so with that much rain, that will help pump those cells up, and I guess I'm not surprised that they're a little bit larger than you would normally expect, just because the amount of rain.
Okay, and the second question, I've got a very large area feet between a lawn and a field, and I purposely let
milkweed.
Yeah, the milkweed. Yeah. Hundreds of milkweed out there, and they're getting bigger, almost blooming now. And I have no monarch butterflies. None of the little larvae.
So you don't have any cat. You're not seeing any caterpillars in all that area.
No eaten leaves. No caterpillars.
Hmm. Well, some, you know, it may take them a year or so to find it. I would just be patient. The other is, I don't know if there's any. I'm sure you know not to use insecticides in the area. That would potentially be a problem. And kill the caterpillars off.
And sometimes they just maybe haven't found it yet. You know? And I've got some milkweed that actually just sort of grew up volunteer right in my flower garden, but I left it because I was hoping that maybe some monarchs had come. And
I'm seeing a lot of people that are doing that now.
Yes.
And I think that's great. But think about, you know, in order to have the caterpillars, the adult butterflies got to come in and lay the eggs on those plants to begin with.
Yeah.
So if the butterflies haven't found them yet, it may take a while, a year or so before they start knowing that you've got some of those milkweeds there.
Yeah. Thanks for calling, Bob. Appreciate it. Bill in Madison, your turn. Hi, Bill. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I was walking through my neighborhood on the near west side of Madison and found a specimen dawn redwood in the front lawn of a house.
Mm-hmm.
It was about 30 feet tall. I just was surprised that they're growing in this area. Is that a tree that you could grow successfully around here?
Yes, you can. And there's some actually at the Arboretum. There are dawn redwoods of a pretty good size. There's some cultivars. I believe it's Shawnee Brave that's a little hardier. So absolutely, you can. If we have a really bad winter like we did 2 years ago and even somewhat this past winter, you will get dieback in them. But, in southern Wisconsin, we can grow them.
Mm-hmm. They had it about 6 feet away from the foundation of the house. Was that a protection or?
That would help. Plus, it being in the city will help because cities are usually warmer. I would not want it 6 feet away from my house, though, because they can get to be really large trees. So,
yeah. Okay. But, thank you very much.
Yep.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And Carol in Grand Marsh. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. Hey, I'm calling about wild grapevines.
Okay.
How to get rid of these things. I have a side lot with this wooded with undergrowth, and these grapevines are all over the place, up to trees, to the power lines. I've been pulling them out, but there's so many of them, and the roots just keep going. You know, you pull them out 3-4 feet, the roots are going on. Is there a way to control these things?
Are you opposed to using herbicides?
No.
Okay, then this is another one that I would treat them in the fall. Because it's a woody plant, I would look for something that's labeled as a brush killer. And you can, if you, you can either, you're going to have to shield your desirable plants, so your trees and that kind of thing. One of the easier ways may even be to cut the stem and then paint the, that stem with the herbicide, the brush killer.
Okay.
It's going to be some work.
Yeah, it's everywhere. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, but keep after it. You'll get it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. All right, thanks a lot for calling. And Glenn in Muskego, hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I've got a neighbor that's got a beautiful columbine vine and a clematis vines. Wondering if I can take cuttings from those and propagate those, and how can I do that?
Clematis, you could do cuttings with it. The columbine, well, it depends on the kind of columbine, but you could even try to collect seeds. Columbine tend to self-seed, but they may not be exactly the same. Or sometimes you can divide them. Not always, though.
But you,
so,
you,
yeah,
it's
worth trying. I would start with the seeds, or even looking around, ask the neighbors to look for little seedlings that are coming up of the columbine and see if you can get something that's similar. It really depends on how hybridized the columbine is.
Yeah.
You know, whether or not it'll come back true from seed.
Yeah, it might not.
It might not. But you still might get a really pretty columbine.
you never know. Oh, my goodness. Our guest today, Barb Larson. Barb is the horticulture educator for University of Wisconsin Extension, works out of Kenosha County, and it's always great to have her with us for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for being with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A happy 4th of July to you, and so happy to have with me today Barb Larson, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Kenosha County, talking about all kinds of things relating to the garden, your flower garden, your vegetable garden. We've talked about trees and shrubs as well. You have a question, I hope you'll join us at 800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'd certainly love to hear from you. We had a question about peppers, Barb, that that came early and I kind of forgot to get to it, so I want to go back to it. Patrick says, my immigrated peppers are stunted and the bottom leaves are falling off. I have had a soil test, and I did the necessary amendments, which I'm not sure where he's writing from, but...
Yeah, so one of the things is where I have seen some peppers this year where the wet soils are affecting them, the cool, wet soils. So that's the first thing I would do is get with your fingers and dig down in that soil a little bit and see if there are lots of nice creamy colored roots and healthy looking roots. If there aren't, then it's probably a root rot kind of problem. Sounds like he had a soil test, did the necessary amendments. You know, when I see it, yellowing and stunting, the other thing I think of is nitrogen deficiencies.
Yeah.
And rain will wash nitrogen down lower in the soil. So that's another possibility that even if you did add some, you may want to add a little more nitrogen, especially if the leaves, the new leaves are looking nice and dark green. Because the nitrogen is taken out of the older leaves and goes to the newer ones, so what's left. So those are my best guesses to begin with on it. As long as there's not spotting or anything like that, I'm thinking it's one of those two.
Bob in Fifield. Hello, Bob. Thank you for calling.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Well, it's a little bit off the subject, but I have a backyard that I've been, it's fenced in since last year, and I've got a dog. She's getting a lot of wood ticks.
Yeah.
Or dog ticks. And I was wondering, I don't want to put anything pesticide or anything that would be. I talked to my vet, and he said that if you spray anything like, Bug Be Gone or anything like that on the lawn, the ticks or whatever would die, and then birds would pick it up and cause a problem with birds. And I'm very conservation-minded, and I certainly don't want to cause any problems with my bird population. Is there anything that you could suggest that would be...
That would help you with the dog.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say, this is outside of my area. Usually, with my dogs, we use the products that are for ticks on, with the on the dogs themselves, and I don't spray the yard and do it that way. So that's what most people are doing.
Yeah, there you put something that... Something that either you spray on the dog or it goes on the collar?
No, it's the ones I use are the ones that go between the shoulder blades on the dogs.
Okay.
And so it's for fleas or ticks and fleas and
tick
things.
And flea control.
Yeah, control. So rather than like a flea collar or anything like that. And that's, I think, what most vets would recommend. But check with your vet. See, I'm a horticulturist, not a veterinarian, yeah. So I would do that.
But that's what you do with your dog.
Yeah, that's what I do with my dogs. And I would say that's what I think most vets are recommending. And
right.
I'm not a fan of, I'm with you, I'm not a fan of doing general sprays of yards and that kind of thing, because it's also not effective for that long a time.
No, and they're just going to come in again.
Yeah.
Keep
your grasses mowed. I know tall grasses, that's a hiding place for ticks. So if you can try to keep the dog out of tall grass, that may help too.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Good luck. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. We had Joan in Menominee up next. Hi, Joan.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just have some information for your listeners and Barb. My sister is a biologist and has sent me a copy of Wings. It's Essays on Invertebrate Conservation.
Okay.
And it's put up by the Xerces Society, X-E-R-C-E-S.
Yep.
And this is the spring of 2014, but it does state in here that since the mid-90s, 1990s, there's been a drop in more than 90% of our monarch population.
Yes.
And it really has, attributed it to using herbicides and insecticides on cropland and, the developing of, land for building on. And they think that has caused a decrease in the milkweed population.
Yes.
Which is what the monarchs need. And so, and they think this is, this loss throughout the Midwest and are thought to be the principal reasons for monarch decline. So, I think that, your other listeners should just stay in there and grow lots and lots of milkweed.
Yep, and I agree. And that's why there has been the push for people to grow more milkweeds and other kinds of, for other pollinators beyond the butterflies, for pollinator plants,
for
too.
Bees and all things. Mm-hmm. It's an incredibly interesting little magazine, and even though I'm not a biologist, I have put in for a subscription to it because
mm-hmm.
yeah. It just answers a lot of the things that we're all talking about right now, like where are all the honeybees and
right.
why don't we see as many bumblebees, and
right.
the one from your listener about why don't I see any monarchs anymore.
Yeah. So Joan might be interested. I don't know if she's heard about it, or Larry, if you've heard about the Million Pollinator Garden Challenge. And it's a national challenge that government's made to try to have people register and plant pollinator plants and then register their gardens and different gardens around the country as pollinator gardens. So you may want to look into that, too. That just came out within the last few weeks.
There we go.
Kind of a neat one.
Thanks, Joan, again, for calling. I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
Bill in Minneapolis, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, Larry, I want to let you know about your show is one of the reasons I support Wisconsin Public Radio.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, see, I got a question. I've got in my backyard a butternut tree that's probably close to 100 years old.
Wow.
And I think this tree is pretty much on its way out, and I'm wondering if there's some way that I can propagate it. Can I plant the nuts off of that tree? How would somebody do something like that?
Absolutely. That's about the only way you're going to be able to propagate a tree that old is to plant the nuts. And I would guess they will need cold moist treatment. So the best way to propagate these trees is to mimic Mother Nature, which would be just plant them in the ground, make yourself a little nursery bed in the backyard someplace, and plant them. Pretend you're a squirrel or whatever, and then hopefully you'll get a bunch of them come up, and after they come up, then you can transplant them and pick the ones that are the strongest and healthiest looking and the straightest and those kinds of things. But rather than trying a bunch of fancy stuff, just plant them in the ground.
Just kind of do it neat.
Mm-hmm.
I understand they're actually quite rare up in this area. Is that correct?
They are very rare because there is a blight that has pretty much wiped out the butternuts.
So if you can, anything you can do is will be much appreciated.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Bill, for calling. Appreciate your call. There is a nut society. I was trying to think of the name of it. They have they're having a meeting, a regional meeting in Wisconsin.
Is that the hazelnut? I know the hazelnut group's has meetings.
We'll be talking about it in the future on the show. I know that for sure because I've got something scheduled, so it's coming up, and we'll get to it eventually.
We'll all wait and try to figure out and listen.
I'll know as soon as I get off the air today. I'll go look. Carolyn in Portage, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
In May, I had a ornamental pear tree planted. And it has been getting little red brownish spots on the leaves, and I was wondering what might be causing that or if there's something I could do for it.
I think it's probably one of the leaf galls, and it may be one that's caused by one of the aerified mites, which are these little tiny weird mite creatures. Doesn't harm it at all. The only thing that it doesn't look as quite as pretty on the leaves, but it doesn't harm the leaves. So usually they kind of go away on their own. They either move down the road a little bit or you'll get other kind of beneficial insects that'll take care of it. So this is ignore it.
Well, thank you so much.
Okay.
I'm glad to hear that.
All right.
Thank you. I enjoy your program.
Thank you very much. We had an email from Jolene in Ashland. My neighbor has a plum tree. She lets me pick every year. They're the best plums around. However, the last several years, the tree's been struggling. Several branches have died, and the remaining branches still produce. This year, the fruits are falling off like crazy. What can we do to save the tree and hopefully the fruit? I haven't seen any insects. I can't remember if there was some kind of scab on the fruits this last year. I think so, but not so far this year.
Yeah. My first concern is an awful lot of trees have lingering cold damage. So that winter of 13-14... there was a lot of damage and there were a lot of trees and shrubs that were damaged, but you didn't see the cold damage to them. And then the plants just they tend have been struggling, and then last year we had a colder than normal winter, so that was kind of an additional issue with it. So I'm seeing a lot of trees that are, and including the fruit trees, that have dead branches in them, dieback in them, and they're just struggling to grow. Since you're in Ashland, you do have a horticulture educator up there, and actually a couple of them. And so I would take into or either photos or even better a sample, especially of the fruits. Could be that the fruits have one of the fungal diseases like black rot or something like that. But take it in, take photos in, or give them a call. And either Matt or Jason, they can help you out.
Jason Fischbach is a guy that's been on the show several times. I bet anything he would have some
answer. He would. Or Matt Cogger works with Jason, too. So
yeah, either
one or the other of them.
All right. Carolyn Oak Creek. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hello there. I live in a small senior apartment building, and the people that own it were so sweet to help us seniors. They built about a 5x10, about a 4-foot high, beautiful enclosed raised garden. And all of our plants look like it's a forest, like a jungle.
That's good.
Pickle bush. I put in my second pickle bush, and the leaves turn yellow. It has tons of buds on it, and it dies. And I'm wondering what it is with the pickle bushes.
Now, pickle bush, do you mean something that you use in pickling?
It's like a pickle climber, but it's a bush.
Is it a cucumber? Okay, so it's a cucumber, but it's one that makes small cukes so that you can make pickles out of them.
Right, there you go.
All right. So we had to figure that out first. I'm wondering,
is there anything have to do with, because it is about 4 feet above the ground, and like I said, everything else is doing spectacular.
So it sounds like they're getting adequate amounts of water. There is a wilt disease that is carried by what's an insect called a cucumber beetle. It's a little tiny yellow and black striped bug. And it carries this fungus in its mouth, and then when it feeds on especially the smaller plants, that fungus gets in and it plugs up the water flow system, the vascular system in it, and then it causes it wilting. That sounds like it.
All right, I'll give it a try and see what I can do.
Okay, well, what you would do is once it gets the wilt, there's not much you can do about it. So what we normally recommend is I like floating row covers on the young plants to keep the bugs off and out of there.
Yeah.
But that's my first guess. That whenever I hear about wilting cucumbers, that's usually what I think it is.
All right.
Pick something like that up at Stein's Nursery.
The floating row covers, sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, over my pickle plant.
Yeah, but if it's really wilting badly, I don't know if you're going to get pickles off of it this year.
Yeah, you might have. It might be for next year. You could still buy it now and have it ready for next
year.
Sure,
and you can try covering and see what happens. The only thing is when you cover. Once you start getting flowers on it, you have to uncover it so the bees can get in there to pollinate those flowers.
Yep, there you go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Mark in Mellon, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Just wanted to let you know that I schedule all my noon breaks right around your show.
Thank you.
I have a small, dilapidated old dairy farm in the Pinocchio Mountains just outside of Mellon. I have a collection area that has water in the springtime, early summer, and then it kind of fades away. And I'd like to know about some plants, low-maintenance plants around there, because I'm on the road all the time.
and also something for around the foundation of the cabin. I'm pulling around out a lot of rock, loose rock, and plant something around the foundation of the cabin.
I would definitely look for native plants in the situation, because you once you get them established, they should take care of themselves. So you want to look for something that's going to be native in that area. And for the water collection area, probably something that will take that kind of spring ephemeral wet area type of thing. There's even things that'll take those kind of spring pond areas or right around those types of areas.
Specific or?
I'm trying to think now where to go to get the information.
Yeah, that's what
the DNR has a publication.
There is, that would have lists for especially that area. Sometimes you may want to even look for a native plant nursery up in that area.
Yeah.
That would probably be your best option.
And melon, okay. There's probably one in Ashland, but melon.
Yeah,
there's one just south of Ashland.
Okay,
yeah.
I would probably work with them.
Yeah, I think that's probably a pretty good idea.
I might check up there.
Yeah,
because they would have an idea of what's going to be native in that area, and they'll also know, depending on the soil types you have and the amount of sunshade, what would work in there too.
Yep.
All right. Thanks.
Yep. Thanks, okay. Mark. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Deborah in Brown Deer. Hello.
Hi. Well, I Googled the nut inquiry, and it was Northern Nut Growers Association out of La Crosse.
There we go.
Oh, okay.
And they have an event coming up on the 26th of July, and you can stay at Reuters Hall. I believe that's how you pronounce it, and it's like $40 a night to stay on campus. And I have one more comment. I have Nora Barlow, which is aquilegia, a form of aquilegia that's really different from the rest. So if that man who called lives near in the Milwaukee area near Brown Deer, he can have all the seeds he wants and just throw them into rocky crevices.
Oh, for columbine, in case people didn't recognize what you were saying, you were using the botanical name.
And I have Kimber Press as a plant dictionary, and it's indispensable.
And you're absolutely right about the Northern Nut Growers Association. We actually have a show coming up with them.
Yeah. And I've always had, we were talking before the break about, I've always had columbines. They just pop up all over the place. So they self-seed.
Yep.
Yep.
All right. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate it. Your call very much. Sylvia said, we had a caller who said there's an exotic milkweed plant that is toxic to butterflies, so she just wanted to warn people to be careful. But the milkweed that just comes up, that sort of free-range milkweed or whatever.
common milkweed is what it's called.
Why couldn't I think of that word? I should have been able to think of that word. The common milkweed is just fine.
That is fine. And then there's also a lot of other native asclepias that, so you can certainly match your soil conditions. So there are ones for dry soil, there are ones for wet soil, all sorts of stuff. So.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
And a low-growing flowering tree that doesn't get fruit.
Well, I'm wondering how low growing. So most of them are going to be 20 to 25 feet tall. And, some of the crab apples, they have fruits, but they're so small or the birds will eat them. So there are some sterile forms, but they're not as good a quality plants. The other thing is I sometimes have people that just take grafted plants and do it that way.
Barb, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much. Happy 4th.
Thank you very much. Have a great holiday weekend, everybody.
She'll be back, and we will talk with her again. Barb Larson, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Kenosha County. Talking about soil next week on Garden Talk, and on Monday at 11, we'll learn about invasive plants with the representative from the Department of Natural Resources. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.